From St. Mary's to Bedford, Pittsburgh to Middletown, this is Lincoln Radio Journal. On this edition, Pennsylvania ran a budget surplus during the last fiscal year. Legislative Republicans say they're holding the line on taxes and regulations created that surplus. State Representative Greg Rothman is here to explain. The Allegheny Institute compares the financial health of Pittsburgh to other like-sized cities across the country. Eric Montardi and Hannah Bowser have an update on this week's Allegheny Institute report. And the left is fighting hard for an increase in the minimum wage, but that would hurt the very people they say they want to help. Anna McCausland of Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania explains on this week's Lincoln Radio Journal commentary. I'm Loman Henry, and welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. We'll get to State Representative Greg Rothman in just a couple of minutes, but first headlines from patownhall.com. Two Democrat presidential candidates made campaign stops in Pennsylvania this past week. Bernie Sanders was in Philadelphia to protest the planned closure of Hahnemann Hospital. The hospital plans to close in September due to financial problems. Sanders, as expected, touted his socialist Medicare for All proposal as a solution to the hospital's fiscal woes. Meanwhile, across the state in Pittsburgh, U.S. Senator Kirsten Gillibrand of New York also focused on health care as she began a bus tour. She, too, supports Medicare for All, which essentially would put an end to private health insurance. Online casino-style gambling got a test run in Pennsylvania last week as the Parks Casino in suburban Philadelphia and the Hollywood Casino near Hershey tested their new platforms. Pennsylvania joins Delaware, New Jersey, and Nevada as the only states that permit such cyber gambling. Gaming in Pennsylvania began as a way to subsidize the state's horse racing industry, but it has expanded to the point where we are the second highest state for casino gambling revenue, lagging only behind Nevada. Feeding wildlife might seem like a good idea to animal enthusiasts, but such feeding causes deer and other animals to congregate near the food source and hastens the spread of diseases such as mange, tuberculosis, and chronic wasting disease. The problem has become so severe that the Pennsylvania Game Commission is considering a ban on the feeding of bears, wild turkeys, deer, and elk. The proposed ban would not include such things as bird feeders. Additional hearings are planned before such a ban would go into effect. And taxpayers will be digging deeper into their wallets to pay state workers. This after the Service Employees International Union, or SEIU, ratified a new contract with the Commonwealth that gives workers a nearly 17% raise over the next 4 years. Employees will not be expected to pay any more for health insurance under the agreement. Read about all things Pennsylvania at patownhall.com. The new state budget is in place, and lawmakers are home for a summer recess. But the fall legislative agenda is beginning to take shape as the political community also begins to look forward to next year's elections. Here to talk about both is State Representative Greg Rothman. Greg represents the 87th State Legislative District in Cumberland County. He also serves as chairman of the House Republican Campaign Committee, the political arm of the House GOP. He is here to talk about both policy and politics. Greg, welcome to Lincoln Radio Journal. Greg, before we begin talking about the upcoming political cycle as it pertains to legislative seats and the election of them, let's just for a couple of minutes go back and take a look at the recently passed state budget. It came together much more harmoniously than past budgets, largely because we had a surplus of revenue from last year. Your thoughts on how we ended up in that situation?
Yeah, we did. Pennsylvania is finally catching up with the rest of the country that's been going through this great economic boom and probably the best economic times of my lifetime. And the last three budgets, the governor had wanted to raise broad-based taxes, wanted to have industry-specific taxes, punitive taxes on the natural gas industry. And the Republicans in both the House and the Senate resisted it, specifically in the House, where we stood up to the governor and said, absolutely not. And because of that, I think Pennsylvania's businesses have been allowed to flourish, and obviously a rising tide that lifts all boats. This is that sort of Jack Kemp, Ronald Reagan Bush tax cut theory that, you know, you keep taxes low and economic growth will raise revenues for the state. And we saw a record amount of revenues come into the state this year. And I believe it's a direct result of us holding the line on taxes.
As we go forward, what sort of plans does the Republican caucus, particularly in the legislature, have? I know you have a number of different sub-caucuses that have been developed that have been working on ways to improve our state's economy and make us more competitive. Because, Greg, if we look at every study that's done of our state's business climate, we're still ranked near the bottom. So do you see major changes that can be made?
Yeah, and we're going to need the governor's help because we can pass regulatory reform, which we did in the House. We passed a great package. It's in the Senate now, which will send a message to businesses outside of our state to come to Pennsylvania that we're open to business. When you drive down 15 and you go into Maryland, there's a sign on the Welcome to Maryland, we're open for business. If you're coming back the other way, I think businesses understand that the regulatory environment in Pennsylvania is very difficult for businesses. And the other thing is that we don't say to businesses, you're welcome here. We have the highest corporate net income tax probably in the country. And if you listen to the Democrats during this budget process, they were talking about severance taxes and raising the minimum wage and more regulation and more environmental regulatory burdens on businesses, where the Republicans were saying, hey, let's make a business climate in Pennsylvania good for the employees and the employers.
And of course, none of those bad things actually did occur, which is a major plus. At least we didn't get worse, if not better. So as we look, Greg, to the fall, any thoughts yet on what the priorities will be for the fall legislative agenda?
Yeah, I think it's more of the same of what we did, which was start addressing a education for the trades. And I know you've been involved in that as well. And we need to create a workforce that meets the needs of, you know, 2020 in Pennsylvania, which at least in Cumberland County, you drive around, there's help wanted signs everywhere. They're paying auto mechanics and contractors $50, $60, $70 an hour. There's a mechanics for hire mechanic sign in Carlisle, $69 an hour to be an auto mechanic. So we need to be promoting the trades. We need to be promoting a workforce that meets that need of the 21st century and continuing on regulatory reform, government reform. We're working on the permit process, trying to make that better. In an interesting turn of events, the governor is teaming up with some of the more conservative members to do some licensing reform and make it easier for people to get licenses in Pennsylvania. And I think that's something we can all get behind. It's sort of a left and right, realizing that you should be able to do business in Pennsylvania without having to go through the government to get permission, like barbers. We have to get a barber exam in Pennsylvania, and the licensing boards, which we'll have to go through, and we're training prisoners in prison to cut hair, and when they get out, they say, oh, but you can't get a license because you have a criminal conviction, which to me is absurd, and I think the governor agrees.
The governor, Greg, actually has been talking about workforce development, and of course, in May and June, when you had the budget approaching, that, of course, takes all the oxygen out of the air. As we head into the fall, do you see perhaps some significant movement toward starting to deal with these workforce development issues?
Yes, that's what I expect we'll be doing, and I think there's a broad coalition of people who want to do it, too, including the governor.
We are talking with State Representative Greg Rothman. He is chairman of the House Republican Campaign Committee. That, of course, is the group that works to elect Republicans to the State House of Representatives. So taking off your legislator hat and putting on your political hat now, Greg, let's talk about where we stand in the legislature. Republicans, of course, are in a majority in both chambers, both the House and the Senate, although those majorities were reduced considerably in last year's election. Let's talk for a minute about what happened there, particularly in the southeastern part of Pennsylvania, in the suburbs outside of Philadelphia. A lot of your former colleagues lost election. What dynamics were at play there, and do you see us moving beyond those dynamics for next year?
Part of it is that we were defending a lot of seats that Hillary had won. I think there were 15 seats in the southeast that Hillary Clinton had beaten President Trump in and were held by Republicans. And so that was certainly part of it. We had the retirement of a couple incumbent congressmen that didn't help. And we had some retirements of our members, too, which made it tougher. But we came back. We're at 110. We have a special election going on in the center of Pennsylvania that will be, I think, August 21st. So we expect to be at 111. There's 203 total. So we have a majority. Our priority is to bring back that majority. And we think there are some seats that we can win back in the southeast. But even more exciting, Loman, is that there are 15 seats in Pennsylvania held by Democrats that Donald Trump won. And ready for this? There are eight of them that Donald Trump won by 20 points or more. And in 2018, Donald Trump was on the ballot, but not on the ballot, right? I mean, the people in the Southeast were running against Donald Trump, but we didn't have a chance to also be promoting Donald Trump. And in 2020, we're going to be running to make sure Donald Trump wins Pennsylvania, and we expect we'll pick up some of those. I mean, we hope to pick up all those seats that are Trump seats held by Democrats.
In terms of what we had in 2018, Greg, did you detect that maybe there was more energy in that cycle on the Democrat side of the coin than on the Republican side? And unlike 2016, where the Trump base was excited?
Yeah, and also, look, you've been around politics campaigns probably longer than I have, but lots of times. And 2016 was a major, major battle. And we left everything on the field in Pennsylvania. And winning Pennsylvania for a Republican for the first time in 30 years, I don't know about you, but I was ready to, you know, I just needed to rest a little bit. And when you're governing, you don't have time to rest. You come back and you get back to work and you start working on policy. And so while the Democrats really started their campaign the day after the inauguration, we were still celebrating and starting to govern. So I think that was part of the letdown. And, you know, historically, off-year elections for incumbent presidents are never good for their parties. You know, Donald Trump is more popular now than he was in 2016, and he won Pennsylvania in 2016. So in Pennsylvania. And if he wins Pennsylvania, I think if history stays, Democrats can't win without Pennsylvania.
In terms of the Trump energy that will be, in all likelihood, and every sign points to returning in 2020, in those suburban counties outside of Philadelphia, Chester, Delaware, Montgomery, Bucks, do you see that as giving Republicans an opportunity to win back some of those seats that were lost in the last cycle?
I do. And remember, all politics is local, and it's still about your local representative. And several of the people that replaced Republicans are part of the socialist, radical, I mean, sort of the nutty caucus within the Democratic caucus, and that might be redundant. But remember, there are three avowed socialists in the House of Representatives now, and they are causing problems for their party. Summer Lee was quoted in the Washington Post. She's a state representative from the Pittsburgh area. She was quoted in the Washington Post as saying, "Capitalism is evil and inherently racist." I mean, if you believe capitalism is evil...
Are you actually seeing a split in the Democrat Party, Greg? I know there was a lot made in 2016 about the fact there was a large Republican field. It took Donald Trump a very long period of time, longer than usual, to consolidate the Republican Party behind his candidacy for president. Obviously, he successfully did that. The Democrats right now, though, seem to be between Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Nancy Pelosi fighting with each other, and Joe Biden, who sort of represents the old guard union blue-collar Democrat constituency, fighting the Democrat socialists. Are we seeing a party actually falling apart here?
Yeah, I think so. And I think the same thing's going on in Pennsylvania in the Democratic Party. I mean, the House members in the state legislature were very upset with Tom Wolf for this, Governor Tom Wolf, for the budget. There were issues that they were upset that he didn't push the minimum wage. They were upset he didn't push more tax increases. They were upset that he allowed the cash assistance program, which was absurd, that they wanted to continue, bring back a program that was so rife with fraud. There were 86 convictions. It was a Democrat, Jack Wagner, Auditor General, who found the waste and fraud in that program, but the Democrats in the House wanted to bring it back. You saw the stunts they played in the state Senate, too, with Senator Katie Muth and Majority Leader. This party and Democratic Party is not, there's no such thing as Reagan Democrats anymore. There were, you know, moderate Democrats or blue dog Democrats. There are older Democrats who are probably looking around trying to figure out where their party's gone, and then these socialists. I mean, they're actually call themselves socialists. We don't have to call them socialists. They do. And someone recently said to me, well, I mean, there really isn't a difference between communism and socialism.
We have been talking with Greg Rothman. Greg represents the 87th Legislative District. That's in Cumberland County, Pennsylvania. And he is chairman of the House Republican Campaign Committee. Greg, if we have listeners who would like to learn more or interact with you, where can they find you on the web?
Yeah, www.gregrothman.com.
Greg Rothman, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Loman. Take care.
How does the city of Pittsburgh compare to other similarly sized cities across the nation? To find out, we turn to Eric Montardi and Hannah Bowser and this week's Allegheny Institute Report.
Hello, and welcome to the Allegheny Institute Report on the Lincoln Institute Radio Journal. I'm Eric Montardi. Joining me today is Hannah Bowser. Hannah is a research assistant with the Allegheny Institute. Hannah, we worked together on a project this summer updating the Benchmark City Report, which is something that the Allegheny Institute started doing in 2004 and has updated every 3 years since. And basically what this Benchmark City Report is a way to measure Pittsburgh's financial performance. When we started this project, Pittsburgh was placed into Act 47 fiscal distress, and it was also placed in oversight under the direction of the Intergovernmental Cooperation Authority, which was always known as the Oversight Board here in Pittsburgh. In the last 18 months, this has all kind of gone away. Pittsburgh was released from Act 47 in February of 2018, and more recently, the state terminated the Intergovernmental Cooperation Authority, which really hadn't done much in the past couple of years. It wasn't funded by the state and got no type of appropriation, so it really wasn't doing much, but because the law said it had to be in place until June 30th of 2019, or the dissolution of the Act 47 recovery team, whichever came later, it took until this end of this month of June for it to be dissolved. So, Hannah, in that kind of backdrop there, the Institute has done this work of updating the benchmark city financial and population numbers over the years. Can you give our listeners just a background and tell them what the cities are that are in the Benchmark City Report?
The cities we used were Salt Lake City, Columbus, Charlotte, and Omaha. And we use them for their varied size and also for their role as a center of regional economic activity.
Once upon a time, we had done a report that looked at comparable size cities. So that would have been, you know, Pittsburgh's population, so in the range of like the 300,000 plus range. And then we also did Rust Belt cities. But you know, we felt like there wasn't a lot to be learned in terms of how do you get a city that's in a state supervision for its finances out of that condition and improve it. So that's when we started to think about, you know, what are some other cities around the country that are of various size population-wise and, you know, better performers, maybe regional hubs, like they host a lot of economic activity for their respective metro area, the way that Pittsburgh does for southwestern Pennsylvania. And that's how we came up with that concept. So, Hannah, let's just give our listeners an idea of what we found here in 2018. We looked at, there was new census estimate numbers that came out. So can you give our listeners details on where population stands as of those 2018 estimates?
Pittsburgh's 2018 estimate, we saw it standing at 301,048 people, while the benchmark stood at 608,471. And so in comparing to the 2010 census, Pittsburgh's population has been in decline. In 2010, it was at 305,704. And the benchmark city experienced the opposite. Their population was increasing since 2010, with a census estimate of 534,002.
Yeah, so definitely going in opposite directions. And as we know, next year in 2020 will be an official census year. So we'll get to see in those interim years what it really meant for Pittsburgh. You know, when there's an official number that settles, as you mentioned, it was about 305,000 at the last official census year. And then the benchmark has gone in the opposite direction and has grown. One of the things that's obviously tied to population is school enrollment. Families are there and they have school-age children and they're sending them to the public school districts, which are in both of these cities. There's some kind of connection there to population growth. What did you find in the report in the analysis this year in 2018 for school enrollment?
We definitely saw an effect with school enrollment. Pittsburgh experienced a decline in their school enrollment with 23,331 students in 2018. But the benchmark, again, experienced the opposite. School enrollment was at 75,412 students. But when we look at this on school enrollment per 1,000, the story is slightly different, still the same overall tune, with Pittsburgh having 77 students per 1,000 residents and benchmark having 129 students per 1,000 residents.
Yeah, and that's a big difference there. Obviously, we're talking about the benchmark with more population, but then also taking it down to the measure of the per 1,000 and looking at how many people then, school-age children, are there relative to the population, and there's a pretty big difference. The heart of what we do with the Benchmark City Report is to look at financial data. We'll look at the audits of each of these cities for the most recently completed year, you know, delve into revenues, taxes, spending, workforce numbers, There's a lot of stuff. And again, since we've been doing this since 2004, we're able to measure some relative changes, looking at the gap between where Pittsburgh stands and where the benchmark city stands, thinking about it as, you know, where is Pittsburgh relative to the benchmark? So let's just summarize here for our listeners just the overall categories. And we're looking at total revenues and total expenditures for 2018 for Pittsburgh and the benchmark city. And again, we're going to look at these on a per capita basis, a per person basis. What did the analysis find?
Both with revenues and expenditures, we can see similar trends. With Pittsburgh, their total revenue per capita in 2018 was $2,111, as opposed to the benchmark's $1,406. And so Pittsburgh revenues are higher than the benchmark and consistently have been since 2005. And now expenditures, again, show a similar story, with Pittsburgh at $2,238 and the benchmark city at $1,478. So again, Pittsburgh's expenditures are higher than the benchmark and have been since 2005.
Pretty big gap. And yeah, as you mentioned, there's a pretty big gap that's remained. All these other indicators we've looked at over the year, there's been some that have gotten worse, some that have stayed the same. As you mentioned, their revenues and expenditures about the same kind of gap. Where has there been a silver lining for Pittsburgh relative to the benchmark? Has there been one? What is it, and what does it look like over time?
The main area of improvement has been the city debt per capita. Pittsburgh's debt in 2018 per capita was $1,330. While the benchmark's per capita debt was $1,123. So again, it's still, Pittsburgh's is still larger, but this gap has shrunk tremendously since 2005. It was a lot larger then, and consistently over the years has been shrinking.
We've mentioned here on this radio show before and in our research that all kind of signs in Pittsburgh were pointing toward this debt cliff, that, you know, there'd be a big bunch of debt that was paid off. It happened this year that the debt principal went down. And then, of course, in other cities that are accumulating more debt, we're talking about a relative gap. Those are the types of things that could be changing, you know, elsewhere. But yeah, that's definitely somewhere that over the years seen a big difference, where per capita debt and things that were related to that number relative to the benchmark when this project started out, it's kind of where things have closed. Hannah, I'd like to thank you today for joining us and giving our listeners some background on the Benchmark City Report. As always, if they'd like to see this report, read more, and read more of some of the archives on this topic as well, they can always visit our website, which is www.alleghenyinstitute.org. For Hannah Bowser, this is Eric Montardi, and this has been the Allegheny Institute Report.
Raising the minimum wage would result in hundreds of thousands of entry-level jobs disappearing. We get details from Anna McCausland of Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania on this Lincoln Radio Journal commentary.
Americans for Prosperity urged Congress to reject the Raise the Wage Act, legislation that would lift the mandatory federal minimum wage to $15 an hour. The current federal minimum wage, which was set by Congress in 2009, is $7.25 an hour. Americans for Prosperity is for breaking down barriers, and certainly remaining in poverty is a tremendous barrier to success. However, the government arbitrarily raising the wage does not lift people out of poverty. It actually causes many to lose the job that they have. While entry-level jobs aren't meant to support a family, they do give new workers, or those needing a second chance, the ability to bone up on the skills they can't teach you in college. How to show up on time, to work hard, get along with your colleagues, respect your boss, your customers, and yourself, and many other valuable traits that will be used in a profession or lifelong career. Multiple studies have shown that the minimum wage hikes hurt the people they intend to help and those least able to afford it. In fact, a professor at the University of California, Irvine, found that 85% of the studies performed on the subject of minimum wage found that an increase in the minimum wage coincided with a decrease in employment, either individuals losing their job or losing hours. A team of researchers at the University of Washington examined the effect of Seattle's wage increase from $9.47 per hour to $13 per hour, and in 2017 concluded that it led to about 5,000 workers losing their jobs and to low-wage workers losing an average of $125 every month. When the government raises the wage arbitrarily, instead of the wage rising according to market forces, people become unemployed or their hours are decreased. Workers who were able to get 40 hours may get cut. In the end, workers aren't making more money, which is the desired outcome of minimum wage increase supporters. In general, increasing the minimum wage tends to reduce employment in two ways. First, higher wages increase the cost to employers of producing goods and services. The employers pass some of the increased costs on to consumers in the form of higher prices. And those higher prices, in turn, lead consumers to purchase fewer goods and services. Second, when the cost of employing low-wage workers go up, the relative cost of employing higher-wage workers or investing in machines and technology goes down. I was at a McDonald's in Lancaster County and ordered my food through a kiosk. It's the first one I've seen in the mid-state area. My kids loved it, and they got exactly what they wanted and got to play with what looked like a 4-foot-tall iPad. When I got my first job at McDonald's at 14, back in 1998, I was the one pushing buttons, ordering food for people. Soon that job may not even exist. Businesses are constantly innovating and eliminating jobs from the past for the technology of the future. The Congressional Budget Office estimated that the Raise the Wage Act could cost millions of jobs and have a detrimental impact on the economy. According to a CBO median estimate, about 1.3 million workers who would otherwise be employed would be jobless in an average week in 2025. That decrease would account for 0.8% of all workers and 7% of directly affected workers who would otherwise earn less than $15 per hour. In Pennsylvania, Governor Wolf has been seeking to raise Pennsylvania's minimum wage, which is the same as the federal minimum wage. According to the Independent Fiscal Office, if he is successful raising it to $12 per hour, nearly 34,000 Pennsylvanians could be out of work. The 2019 Pennsylvania Department of Labor and Industries Minimum Wage Advisory Board report found that nearly 85% of minimum wage earners do not have children. Over 30% are teens, and 60% are under 25, not the largest percentage of individuals having children. Also, the same report shows that many people that earn the minimum wage live in a household with an income over $75,000 per year. They aren't supporting a family. Many are entry-level employees getting their start and learning the soft skills necessary to make it in their chosen profession later in life. That's the intent of the minimum wage, for new employees to demonstrate their competency, learn skills, and work their way up the ladder of success. We want companies to pay their workers a fair wage that takes their skills, expertise, and experience into account. We want employees to be able to negotiate a higher wage or more flexibility for themselves if they deserve it. However, we don't want the government to arbitrarily pick what the wage should be. The market is much better at that. I'm Anna McCausland, Deputy State Director with Americans for Prosperity Pennsylvania. Find us online at americansforprosperity.org, on Twitter at AFP Pennsylvania, and on Facebook at facebook.com/fightback.
If you miss hearing Lincoln Radio Journal on your favorite radio station, audio of our complete program is available on our websites, lincolnradiojournal.com and lincolninstitute.org. For 24 years, Lincoln Radio Journal has been heard on public affairs-minded radio stations throughout the Commonwealth, including WCHE-AM in Westchester, WEDO-AM in White Oak, along with WAEB-AM and WKAP-AM in Whitehall, Pennsylvania. The Lincoln Radio Journal is produced weekly by the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. The Lincoln Institute is completely funded through the generosity of individuals, corporations, and philanthropic foundations, including the Allegheny Foundation of Pittsburgh, the Houston Foundation of Coatesville, the Worrell Foundation of Carlisle, and the Pennsylvania Manufacturers Association, all of whom have helped to underwrite the costs of this program. Lincoln Radio Journal is a trademark of the Lincoln Institute of Public Opinion Research, Incorporated. Comments and opinions expressed on this program are those of the guests and do not necessarily reflect the views of the Lincoln Institute or of this radio station. From the Lincoln Broadcast Center in Harrisburg, I'm Loman Henry. Thank you for listening to Pennsylvania's most widely broadcast public affairs radio program, Lincoln Radio Journal. Plug into the pulse of Pennsylvania.
Thank you.